expense of the Palestinian people and on the expense of their blood and on their neighborhoods as well. More than 100 people have been killed since the beginning of the ceasefire more than 10 weeks ago. Since the beginning of the ceasefire, these violations have been non-stop, attacking the people's homes and attacking the people's returning to their homes and to their areas in the eastern parts of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli occupation is claiming that these people or these population are trying to go back to areas that are penetrating the yellow line, the so-called yellow line. However, this yellow line includes more than 53% of the total areas withdrawn from, and that is a huge, huge spaces for the Palestinians. We are talking about half of the people or half of the population are now unable to return back to their homes and to their areas in the eastern part of Gaza City. Again, this is a bold violation of the ceasefire agreement, and that this is another violation. The other is attacking fatally the people who are trying to go back to these areas. Again, the Israeli occupation army is clinging to protect, you know, in order like to kill or to mass shoot towards the Palestinian people. This is happening in a very important context. The Israeli occupation army wants the people in Gaza to feel the presence of the Israeli troops. They want them to feel and to fear the presence of the Israeli troops in these areas. In particular, they don't want the Palestinian population to feel the calmness or to breathe the calmness of a ceasefire taking place. So again, the situation remains really very tense, and people are very cautious nowadays. They are anticipating what the coming days will bring very cautiously, because the Israeli occupation army is actually attacking, does not abide to the ceasefire agreement. And another bold violation of the ceasefire agreement is not allowing the unrestricted flow of aid into the Gaza Strip. Regarding the ceasefire agreement, it is supposed to allow the entry of at least 600 trucks per day. However, this number has not been allowed to enter to the Gaza Strip since the beginning of the ceasefire. This number, what is allowed to enter into the Gaza Strip, is far below this number. And many of these trucks are actually merchandising goods that are sold in the local markets with very expensive prices. Most of the people here cannot afford to buy. Again, the situation remains really dire. The famine is still taking hold against the population, against the people here in the Gaza Strip. The medical facilities in the Gaza Strip are experiencing very hard times trying to provide the medical care and the medical services amidst the very acute and very dire shortages of all the medical supplies and the fuel.
I'm going to have to cut you off there, as always, as you did clearly show the continued suffering of the Palestinians, not only from the violations of the Zionist entity, but the continued lack and dire humanitarian situation. Ghada Brahim, our correspondent there, joining us from Deir al-Balah, thank you very much. The Hamas resistance movement says a delegation led by its Gaza leader, Khalil al-Hayya, is in the Egyptian capital of Cairo to follow up on the implementation of the ceasefire agreement. The movement said in its statement that the delegation will discuss the implementation of the truce deal with the mediators, as well as other Palestinian factions and groups. It added that the delegation will also explore ways to reinforce the truce and halt repeated Israeli violations. The new development came after Hamas reaffirmed in an earlier statement its full commitment to the ceasefire agreement, placing full responsibility for any escalation or collapse of the deal on the Israeli regime. The movement said it has abided by the agreement in both letter and spirit and has taken no stop to breach or obstruct the deal. Hamas also called for urgent international intervention to ensure the implementation of the truce and stop Israel's violations. While students at the University of Houston have staged a hunger strike in a show of solidarity with Palestinians suffering under a years-long Israeli siege in the Gaza Strip. We have a report.
UH divest from debt.
UH divest from debt.
UH divest from debt.
UH divest from debt.
Today, students at the University of Houston have entered the third day of a hunger strike in solidarity with Gaza. Their protest is part of a growing wave of student-led actions across U.S. campuses, calling attention to the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and demanding institutional accountability. The hunger strike targets the university's financial and research ties to weapons manufacturers and technology firms involved in global arms production. Students argue that these companies play a direct role in enabling Israel's military campaign in Gaza, which has drawn international condemnation for widespread civilian casualties and destruction of infrastructure. Participants have issued a list of demands to the university administration. These include divesting from weapons companies, canceling all military research contracts, removing brands linked to apartheid from campus, and declaring the university a sanctuary campus. These demands reflect a broader call for ethical investment and institutional transparency. In recent days, more students have joined the strike, signaling growing concern over the university's partnerships and funding sources. Organizers say the action is not only about Gaza, but also about challenging the role of academic institutions in perpetuating violence through financial and research collaborations.
Today is day 3 of the Samud hunger strike. I am announcing my entry into the strike because the university has made it apparent that they will not answer our demands without escalation.
The protest comes amid a global outcry over the humanitarian conditions in Gaza, where famine and displacement have intensified following months of blockade and bombardment by the Israeli regime. Students across the U.S., Canada, and Europe have launched similar hunger strikes, encampments, and sit-ins, demanding that universities sever ties with companies complicit in the genocide. Activists argue that universities must take moral responsibility for their connections to the military-industrial complex. They emphasize that academic institutions should not profit from war or occupation, and must instead stand for human rights, peace, and justice.
Well, hundreds of pro-Palestine protesters have rallied through the Spanish capital, Madrid, in solidarity with the Palestinian people in Gaza. Protesters chanted slogans demanding an end to the Israeli regime's ceasefire violations. The demonstrators slammed Israel for preventing the entry of humanitarian supplies into the besieged territory. They also denounced the United States for aiding Israel in its genocide in Gaza, calling for justice for the Palestinians killed during the Israeli onslaught. Describing Israel as the worst apartheid, the protesters called for a just and lasting peace in Gaza. On Sunday, Palestinian officials announced that Israel has committed 80 violations since the truce started, resulting in 97 deaths and 230 injuries. A viral video from the occupied West Bank is making global headlines. Captured by an American journalist, the footage shows masked Israeli settlers ambushing Palestinian farmers during the olive harvest, an attack that has reignited calls for accountability and protection. We have details in this report.
Tensions continue to escalate in the occupied West Bank as Israeli forces and settlers intensify their actions against Palestinian communities. A shocking new video has surfaced, capturing a brutal ambush by Israeli settlers on Palestinian farmers. On October 19th, as Palestinian farmers began their olive harvest in Termas Aya, chaos erupted. A Brooklyn-based journalist, Jasper Nathaniel, was on the scene, capturing spine-chilling footage of masked Israeli settlers attacking Palestinian farmers with crude melee weapons. In a post shared on social media, Nathaniel described the harrowing experience.
On the first day of the olive harvest, the Israeli force leads a group of farmers directly into a brutal ambush by armed settlers. These people need to be in prison by tomorrow, and the people of this village, and all across Palestine, need to be protected. Enough is enough.
Following the attack, Nathaniel reported his ordeal to the U.S. Embassy, only to be told they could not provide protection. He then wrote on the social media X that, "The U.S. Embassy said that no, they cannot protect me." The incident has sparked a wave of reactions online. One user pointed out the glaring double standards in international responses, stating that if an American tourist were attacked in any other country, it would lead to a major diplomatic crisis.
If an American tourist was being chased and attacked by masked and armed government-backed terrorists in any country other than Israel, it would be immediately become a major diplomatic crisis with wall-to-wall media coverage.
As Nathaniel's clip went viral, Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Palestine, shared Nathaniel's video, emphasizing that such violent incidents have persisted for years without accountability.
For 2 years, the world has seen scenes like this from the West Bank. I wonder where decent Israelis are, those who protest in Tel Aviv. Hatred of Hamas is one thing, but do they not feel some obligation to act to stop their fellow citizens behaving like criminals on the loose?
This latest episode of Settler Violence comes amid a fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in the Gaza Strip. As tensions rise and violence escalates in the West Bank, the international community is left grappling with how to respond to these alarming developments.
Well, another Palestinian abductee has died in Israeli jails after the regime denied him medical treatment despite his deteriorating health. According to Palestinian sources, 49-year-old Mahmoud Talal Abdullah was abducted from the Jenin refugee camp by Israeli forces in early February. Abdullah's health condition deteriorated sharply after his abduction, and he was later diagnosed with advanced cancer. Despite his condition, the Israeli regime refused to release him, transferring him from one prison to another and keeping him in detention until his death. Abdullah had previously been detained during the Al-Aqsa Intifada in 2002. His death brings the number of Palestinian abductees who have died in Israeli prisons since the start of the regime's Gaza genocide to 79. Well, Yemenis have gathered in the streets of Sana'a to hold a funeral procession for Major General Mohammed al-Ghamadi, the chief of the staff of the Yemeni armed forces who was martyred in an Israeli strike. Now we're joined by our correspondent Abdul Latif al-Washari for more. Abdul Latif, let's remind that the general was not assassinated by himself. He had several comrades with him, and of course also his son. His young son was with us. What has and how important is Major General Mohammed al-Ghamadi specifically over the last few years with the solidarity with Palestine?
Thank you so much. Thousands of people poured into Jami' al-Sha'b today in the capital of Sana'a to bid farewell to Major General Mohammed Abdul Karim al-Ghamadi with his son and two companions who were with him while the Israeli strike hit the building they were in. You know, General Mohammed Abdul Karim al-Ghamadi was one of the country's most prominent military leaders. He was known for his achievements in the missile program. He was also known for leading the Red Sea operations against the Israeli vessels and also leading the missile forces to hit the Israeli territories. He was one of the most prominent leaders. He was very important for the Yemeni army, for the Yemeni people. Today, the atmosphere was charged with grief and also with the pride and sincere feelings. They loved this leader. They knew that he was leading the Yemeni army during the past 2 years and even before. But you know, the past 2 years since the beginning of Al-Aqsa flood, it was a very sensitive phase of the confrontation with the Israeli enemy. So the people were there today. Thank you to General Mohammed al-Ghamadi for the achieving milestones and developing, you know, cluster munitions and also hypersonic missiles that hit Israeli cities several times. The people today thank General Mohammed al-Ghamadi, and they are very trusting the new leader, the chief of staff in the Yemeni army. The new leader is Yusuf al-Madani. We hope that he will do as well as Sayyid Muhammad al-Ghamadi.
Yemeni people have proved more than once that they are definitely steadfast in the support of the Palestinians until the regime stops its genocide. There, everyone, our correspondent Abdul Latif al-Washali joining us from Sana'a. Thank you very much. Well, Iran has once again reiterated that the country is entitled to nuclear enrichment and other peaceful nuclear activities after UN Security Council Resolution 2231 expired on Sunday. Iran's foreign ministry called on the secretariat of the council to also consider the resolution terminated. Ismail Baghai said the UN Security Council never decided on the reinstatement of anti-Iran sanctions under the resolution snapback mechanism before the resolution expired. Baha'i said the UK, France, and Germany abused international mechanisms for their political purposes. This, he said, has faced opposition by the majority of the world countries. China and Russia have issued a joint statement with Iran to underline the expiration of Resolution 2231. The non-aligned movement also recently endorsed Iran's position on the resolution and the termination of the UN sanctions against the country.
Well, thank you very much for the Sarah's headlines. For more updates, as always, please stay tuned to World News. Bye for now.
Allah. Square, one of the biggest and most beautiful squares in the world. A UNESCO World Heritage Site that must be on your bucket list.
Naqsh-e Jahan Square is located in the center of the city of Isfahan. It was built during the 17th century, during the Safavid era. This square, with its rich historical background, is one of the most spectacular attractions of the city of Isfahan.
On the western side of Naqsh-e Jahan Square, you find an exquisite palace, which is known as Ali Qapu. It was built during the Safavid era, and it was considered the political center of the country.
Ali Qapu literally means great gate. The palace is actually a six-story building, but you won't realize this until you go to the backyard. It was here that the Safavid king would entertain his special visitors. He also celebrated Nowruz, the Persian New Year.
We've just been to the palace. It's absolutely beautiful. We went up the staircase to the number of levels. We just saw the amazing decorative artwork. And then went up to the top chamber where we believe the musicians used to play, the amazing acoustics.
This amazing structure is rich in wall paintings. The doors, walls, and ceilings are highly ornamented with intricately designed floral motifs. On the sixth floor is where royal receptions were held and was referred to as the music hall.
One of the main attractions of Naqsh-e Jahan Square are the mosques that are located in it. Mosques that are not only considered masterpieces of Iranian Islamic architecture, but that are famous for their tile works.
Imam Mosque, also known as Jame Abbasi Mosque, is on the south side of the square. It is considered an excellent example of the Islamic era architecture of Iran. Its splendor is mainly due to the beauty of its seven-color tiles.
Probably the most amazing part of this mosque is its tile works. The tiles are so intricately designed that you can even find postcards and replicas of them around the square.
The magnificent tile work serves a double function. Aside from ornamenting the mosque, there was a need to weatherproof the simple clay bricks used in its construction. The tiles are decorated in seven colors, which is why they are called haftrang, which literally means seven colors.
It's absolutely beautiful. It's so big and colorful. And what else then?
Yeah, the tiles and the decorations are amazing, aren't they?
You can find one of the most exquisite masterpieces of Iranian architecture, Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque, which was built by Shah Abbas I of the Safavid dynasty.
What fascinates me most about this mosque is, first of all, architecturally, it's a unique work. You don't have anything like that in any part of Iran or elsewhere, because it's a private mosque built for the father-in-law of Shah Abbas the Great. In terms of ornament, what fascinates me most is the interplay of natural tile colors with various sorts of blue color, and these in the whole composition, the composition of natural tile color with blue. That's unique, and that's very nice.
I can't tell you enough about the beauty of Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque, but in my opinion, the most amazing part is the tile work under the dome. And if you're familiar with Persian carpets, you will find this design quite familiar.
Isfahan is one of the oldest and largest bazaars in the Middle East. Some parts of it are more than 1,000 years old. The bazaar is abundant in handicrafts, so if you're looking for a little something to take back, this is where you need to go.
Probably one of the most interesting parts of Naqsh-e Jahan Square is Qaisariya Bazaar, one of the longest bazaars in the world that connects Naqsh-e Jahan Square to Atiq Square. It's about 8 kilometers long.
The square is still as vibrant as it was, today mostly with the presence of tourists rather than merchants, but is still reminiscent of its days of glory, when public ceremonies were held, movies were celebrated, and polo games were played.
Now, after all of these amazing things, there's only one thing I can say. Visiting Naqsh-e Jahan Square must be on your bucket list.
Gizum Shahmadi for Iran.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sassi. He's a professor.
The Spotlight.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Spotlight. A pivotal moment has arrived for the Islamic Republic of Iran and the international community. As of October 18th, 2025, the United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231 has officially expired. Iran's foreign ministry has declared that all restrictions on the country's nuclear program are now terminated, marking the formal and legal conclusion of this chapter. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi has formally notified the United Nations, stating that the nuclear dossier must now be removed from the Security Council's agenda and that Iran's program should be treated like that of any other non-nuclear weapons state under the NPT. This landmark event comes despite a last-ditch effort by the three European parties to the JCPOA, Britain, France, and Germany to trigger the so-called snapback mechanism in an attempt to reimpose past sanctions. That move has been declared void and illegal, not only by Tehran, but also by key powers, Russia and China, who have vowed not to even recognize it. So So what does this mean for Iran's strategic future? How should the nation navigate this new landscape? And what are the consequences for the failed Western policy of maximum pressure? Before we start, we have more details in this report.
Iran's foreign ministry has announced that the 10-year period stipulated in the UN Security Council Resolution 2231 has expired as of October 18, 2025, marking the formal conclusion of all restrictions related to the country's nuclear program.
The Iranian nuclear issue, which is on the Security Council agenda under the heading of nonproliferation, should be removed from the UNSC's agenda. The entire purported purpose of putting the Iranian nuclear issue on the Security Council agenda was to ensure the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program and that it would not be diverted towards weapons development. This goal has been fully achieved, as no report to the contrary has been published by the International Atomic Energy Agency, and despite pressure from free European countries and the United States.
The ministry said Iran's nuclear program should be treated like that of any non-nuclear weapons state party to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It said the European Troika's move to trigger the snapback mechanism does not in any way affect the legal framework established under Resolution 2231, including its expiration timeline. Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi has also formally notified the UN Secretary General and the President of the Security Council that Resolution 2231 expired on October 18. He decried as void any attempts by three European signatories to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal to revive and reinstate the previously terminated UN sanctions and resolutions against the Islamic Republic.
In recent months, instead of fulfilling their obligations, the three European parties pursued a new campaign of political manipulation and legal distortion, seeking to turn the so-called snapback mechanism into a tool against Iran. The European parties' attempt to invoke the so-called notification is procedurally defective and substantively void. No measure taken in disregard of Resolution 22-31 can generate legal obligations for member states. Accordingly, any claim of reviving or reinstating terminated resolutions is void, lacking legal foundation and incapable of producing a binding effect.
Russia has also released a statement saying that the issue of nuclear non-proliferation oversight regarding Iran must now be removed from the UN Security Council's agenda. It said cooperation between Russia and Iran across various sectors will proceed with full compliance with national laws and international obligations. China and Russia have both rejected the Europeans' bid to reimpose UN sanctions on Iran. In a joint statement, the two countries, which are parties to the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, officially announced that they consider the snapback of UN sanctions against Iran as illegal and invalid, and that they will not abide by them. Now that Resolution 2231 has expired, Iran considers this issue closed. From this point forward, Tehran says its nuclear program must be treated like that of any other country that has pledged not to develop nuclear weapons under the standard oversight of the IAEA, and that the E3's illegal snapback attempt only confirms their bad faith.
Well, with us to discuss these critical questions are Ms. Hatima Sahayi Biria, academic and political analyst, joining us from Tehran. And Mr. Reza Vidadi, academic researcher and author, joining us from London. I'd like to welcome both of you during this episode of Spotlight. Ms. Hakima, I'm going to go ahead and start off with you. I mean, from a legal standpoint, how indisputable is Iran's position that this resolution, 2231, has indeed expired and that all the restrictions are lifted?
Yes. Thank you for having me. Let me begin by saying that the approach that Iran is taking on this issue is completely based on the legal mechanisms that were in place in the JCPOA agreement and, of course, inscribed in the UN 2231 resolution. The idea was that if any of the parties, any of the participating parties to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action found Iran was non-compliant with its side of the agreement, then they should have started the procedure, begin, you know, starting basically a committee for resolving this issue, and then after that procedure was done, then if it couldn't be resolved, then they could basically bring it to the attention of the Security Council and snap back the sanctions. And of course, what happened was that the United States withdrew unilaterally from the deal during the first Trump administration, so the United States is no longer a participating member. After the United States exited the deal, Iran still complied with this side of the deal for a while, trying to revive the deal and keep it going, keep it alive with the European Union, the E3, and of course China and Russia. And of course, E3 didn't comply with their side of agreement, and they, under American pressure, they basically did not allow Iran to use any of the benefits of the deal. So after more than a year, Iran basically came back to some of the, you know, some of the activities, the non, you know, the peaceful activities that are part of this nuclear program. So now we do not have any participating member in the JCPOA that can basically trigger these this mechanism and, you know, bring about the procedures into effect. So that is basically a legal the legal argument that Iran is making, and of course China and Russia are making, and of course I believe other countries are going to join and not abide by this illegal move that the E3 have basically started.
Yes, Ms. Hakima, if you don't mind me cutting in there, since you did, you go ahead and bring up China and Russia. I do want to bring in Mr. Riza joining us from London. Thank you very much for your patience, sir. How significant was the support from Russia and China, not only legally but also politically, in neutralizing this European move, in your opinion?
I believe the Russian and Chinese cooperation with Iran is not just in the benefit of Iran, but also in the benefit of China and Russia. We understand that the United States has realized that the swing of power and rise of economy is shifting towards the east. Then it's the interest of Russia and China to strengthen Iran's hand, because we know that once they finish with Iran, they will then turn towards Russia and China. And once Russia and China are weakened, then they will, the West, you know, United States, followed by Europe, will maintain its hegemony over the world. And that's what the ultimate goal of all of this, you know, UN Security Council resolutions and the pressure on Iran. It's nothing to do with nuclear weapons. They know that Iran doesn't want nuclear weapons. And if Iran has 100 nuclear weapons, the United States has 10,000 nuclear weapons. So it's nothing to do with nuclear weapons. It's to do with the swing of power and weakening these countries that resist the United States and its colonial project, you know, Zionism and Europeans that ally the United States. So I think that the Russians and China have realized now that it's a time to cooperate with Iran. And we saw that Dr. Ali Rajani, who is the head of Iran's National Security Council, visit Putin yesterday, I believe, and he took a letter from Ayatollah Khamenei directly to him. So they close cooperation. We saw the representative of Russia in Vienna, the UN Security Council in Vienna, declared in his X account only an hour or so ago that the agenda, the Iran nuclear issue, had been removed from the agenda, the Security Council agenda, so that's it, so it doesn't keep coming up anymore. So all of these steps are being taken, and so that Iran now can trade with weapons. The only thing happens now is that the West, the United States, and Europe will try to put pressure on Iran, possibly through the ships that it uses to transfer oil and other goods. But then Iran is also aware of that.
Well, exactly, Mr. Riza. I mean, you bring up a very interesting point about the repercussions of this from the West. If we move a bit to the whole geopolitical repercussions and, of course, the West's position, Ms. Hakima, I mean, is there a risk, as what Mr. Riza is saying, of a E3 and the U.S. basically, even perhaps moving towards forming an illegal coalition outside the U.N.
to, of course, maintain pressure, as Mr. Rizal said. And how should Iran respond in this case?
Of course, that has been the status quo ever since Iran's nuclear issue was raised in 2001. We have had the United States trying to pressure all other countries into succumb to what the U.S. is, the U.S. pressure is attempting to do against Iran's nuclear program. And of course, the European Union and the E3 especially have shown that they have no independence in their foreign policy with regard to the United States. That is the possibility. But the thing is that we are in a different world now. Despite the fact that we see so much, so much activity on the part of the United States to basically bring about the resemblance of colonialist policies to the world scene once again. You know, you see that everywhere there is talk of using power to have U.S. policies be accepted by other countries. But I think we are in a different world now. We are in a world where multilateralism is also part of the activities of many countries, especially those that have formed other coalitions, including BRICS, including the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, including the Group of the Friends of the UN Charter, of which Iran is a party to all three, and of course Russia and China are party to all three. So this coming together of these three countries is important at this juncture in time when many countries are basically trying to escape this unilateralism on the part of the United States, trying to find room for maneuvering, independent policies. So I think, yes, on the part of the United States and the E3, you could see an attempt to bring about a coalition to pressure Iran and pressure other countries. That has been the status quo. We have to see if Iran, Russia, and China, along with other independent-oriented countries, can try to bring about a situation where this ambiguity with regard to this snapback mechanism can basically open the ground, open the space for new realities to emerge, for the world to basically move to a more multilateral approach to basically these sort of policies.
Yes, and Mr. Rez, I actually have a two-part question. First of all, your response to Ms. Hakima, she was saying that we basically live in a new world at the moment. How much of that do you agree with? And the second part, which she was talking about, this maximum pressure campaign, how do you believe it would impact any type of future negotiations with Iran on perhaps other issues?
I will answer to the first question. On many occasions on your program, on Press TV, I have stated that we are moving towards a multipolar world. I believe now we are at the beginning of the multipolar world. It's not that we're going to get there, we're already there. And the powers become more clear. The polars of powers become more clear as time passes, and Iran is one of those powers. To answer the first question, to answer the second question, I believe that Iran, I think at the moment, is exporting or producing 4 million barrels of oil. So whatever this maximum pressure that Donald Trump and his American regime wants to put in Iran, it's not working. The world is changing. There's other ways of paying other than the U.S. dollar. India recently said that they will not stop purchasing Russian oil, even though they have a lot of trade in the United States. So it's easier for the United States to put pressure on India. The United States has no trade whatsoever with Iran. Europeans have minimum trade with Iran, so whatever leverage that they had before, be it through the negotiations, before the snapback mechanism that they tried to trigger, all of these things that they had before, ways of Iran wanting to engage with them and then using that as lever, has been destroyed. They literally cut all the mechanisms, all their methods of putting pressure on Iran. They even tried the war, which we discussed before, for 12 days, and that didn't work. So they've tried everything that they can, and so now Iran, it has become a better situation for Iran that they have no more connection with the negotiations with Europe. activated, because now Iran realizes that there's no path ahead for its success, for its internal and foreign policy success, negotiations with the West. It has to stand on its own two feet and follow the same policy that Ayatollah Raisi started, which was, we are open for negotiation, but we will not wait around for the West. We will make friends with our neighbors. We will trade with anyone around the world who wants to trade with us. And that should be the policy that the current administration is on, Dr. Pezeshkian. Hopefully that's what he's taking on, and hopefully that's what he will continue to take on.
So let's go ahead and talk a bit about Iran's nuclear program and, of course, its strategic future. Ms. Hakim, let me go and start with you. Now that these restrictions have indeed, they're basically gone, let's say, are there any immediate changes that we could possibly see in Iran's nuclear energy program under, of course, the continued so-called safeguards of the IAEA?
Of course, under these safeguard agreements, Iran has obligations, but also Iran can use the benefits of the NPT for having a peaceful nuclear program. Under these the regulations that are there, there is no issue with a country having the uranium enrichment for peaceful purposes. There is no restrictions on Iran using all the available means for, using its nuclear capabilities for peaceful purposes, which includes, uses for medicine, uses for, all the different arenas that are there. So Iran has shown that it is willing, and it is basically has the will to withstand the pressure that has been on it. We have had years of coercive diplomacy happening being orchestrated against Iran. What we have had over the years, over the past 24 years, has not been real negotiations, has been coercive diplomacy. We have had negotiations with Western countries, but at the same time, there has been lots of pressure for Iran not to be able to use the benefits of the nuclear non-proliferation agreement. And of course, under the Iran has been forced over the years to voluntarily do more than it is required to do. So now, from this moment on, Iran is saying that the rules of the game are going to be as it is for everyone else. Iran is going to follow the rules, but not any more than is required of Iran under its safeguard agreements. So this is what Iranian people want, and it is what Iran has strived for it over the past decades, and of course Iran has paid a heavy price for it. It has paid with the blood of its nuclear scientists. So I think at this moment in time, Iran is even more vigilant to basically progress in terms of peaceful nuclear technology.
And Mr. Reza, if you could please, in around 2 minutes, now that this legal basis for the UN sanctions has indeed expired, is there any type of legal arguments for any foreign companies to actually continue hesitating on entering the Iranian markets as of today, October 18, 2025?
Any company or any country that has a strong trade with the United States and Europe, they will have pressure from the United States and from Europe not to trade with Iran, and that's been the case in the last since 2017-18 when Donald Trump left the JCPOA. So that will continue. But however, what's happening, the foreign minister of Iran day ago was with non-aligned members, or a few days ago with non-aligned members in Uganda, and they all agreed to a statement that Iran is not bound by any of the resolutions from before. And so this demonstrates that a lot of countries are moving away from this binary of not being able to trade with Iran because of the pressure from the United States. They're wanting to trade with Iran and countries like Iran who are under sanctions, because it's not just Iran who's under sanctions, Russia is under sanctions, and so many other countries are under sanctions. And so they've realized that if they just follow this pressure from the United States, it disadvantages their countries because the United States and Europe are not providing what they need. So slowly, the United States, from using the sanction mechanism that it has, the unilateral sanction mechanism that it has weakened its own sanction abilities. And so this is in the benefit of Iran. Iran needs to just be patient, to continue its trade and build its strength. And I think within a few years, you realize that the United States sanctions have become so weak that they're not as important as they were 10 years ago.
And I do have one final question, but perhaps please, in just one sentence, as we do have 1 more minute left, how would you summarize the significance of today, October 18, 2025, for the Islamic Republic of Iran? Ms. Hakima, your sentence, please.
Yes, it is going to change basically the rules of the game. Countries do not have to give up their rights. The countries should not be pressured to give up what they have worked for over the years just because of the pressure from formerly colonial powers who think they are still living in a colonial world. We are very much moved past that era, and we are entering a new one, and Iran is trying to show the world, and of course I think Iran is going to get the support from many countries, as our other guests mentioned, and this is going to be the beginning of a new era in world politics, I hope.
And Mr. Reza, very briefly, please, your sentence.
Yes, I agree with the statements of our other hosts. And I think, as I said, Iran needs to just maintain its course, which it has. It's built up a strong military. Its now focus should be economy and international relations, which it's doing fine.
Well, I'd like to thank both of our guests today during this episode of Spotlight. From Tehran, Ms. Hakima Sarghaibiria, academic and political analyst. And, of course, from London, Mr. Reza Vidadi, academic researcher and author. A pleasure to have you both. Well, thank you very much for joining us during this episode. Goodbye for now.
welcome back, dear listeners. Here's a glimpse of what's coming up next on our schedule. For this hour, it's time to listen to For Humanity, hosted by Hujjatul Islam Hamza Azizi. This program covers a variety of subjects concerning human being in the Noble Quran, which include individual and social issues such as the family and how to interact with other faithful Muslims from the point of view of the Holy Quran. And after this program, we shift our focus to economic divide. If you are interested in economic or business issues, then this program is definitely for you. Top experts on the economy give expert analysis and commentary on the biggest business and economic stories of the day. Finally, we present Spring of Truth. Spring of Truth features English translations of selected powerful statements and speeches from the founding father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini. May Allah bless his soul. Please stay with us. Up next is For Humanity.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents. For Humanity.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful, and may great peace and blessing be upon Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his household. Assalamu alaikum, my dear audience, brothers and sisters, and welcome back to the series of talks for humanity. I'm Hamza Azizi from IRIB English Radio. Sure, you remember we've been talking about the Quranic teachings about the individual and personal attributes of human beings, regardless of his communications with other human beings or with whoever is around him. We are talking about the individual attributes of the ideal human being in a Quranic point of view. Previously, we talked about several aspects, or let's say several attributes and ideal behaviors. We talked about at-tafakkur, thinking. We talked about gaining knowledge. We talked about working, trying, and we talked about the purity and impurity.